You are Locked On Pirates, your daily podcast on the Pittsburgh Pirates, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Pirates fans, it is Thursday, April 12th, 412. Happy 412 to you Pittsburghers. This is Cannonballs on Locked On Pirates, your Pittsburgh Pirates podcast of choice. Today, this is Jared Prugar filling in for Jason Rollison. Little pinch hit duty, and I'm joined by Alex Stumpf and Josh Taylor. Gentlemen, welcome.
Hey, great to be here. You are my Cannonball's nemesis, so I'm going to call shenanigans if Josh ends up winning, but I'm still excited nonetheless.
Well, you know, it's...
I'll just say it's good to be back in 2018.
Yes.
I'll keep it simple.
I like the simplicity, Josh, but you, I might be your nemesis, Alex. However, Josh is mine. Josh is the lone person to beat me on Cannonballs. So now that I've semi-graced into retirement, and now I'm just hosting, it's a nice life, you know? Nemesis versus nemesis, it's kind of neat.
This is a Godzilla versus King Kong situation right now.
Hey. I'd be happy with just being Rodan, honestly. That's just me, though. Just saying.
It's glad to be back with you guys, and I do mean that, whether I'm your nemesis or you're my nemesis. But let's get down to it. We've got a nice three slated questions for the day. So let's get started. First one, Alex, you'll get to answer this first since you are the returning champion, and because I feel bad for beating you all the time. Has the team's 8-2 start changed your perception and prediction for the team? Why and why not?
Am I allowed to answer a little bit? Because I came into this year thinking this was going to be an 81-81 team. I wasn't willing to commit either one more win or one more loss to say winning or losing season because they looked fairly average. And if you look at this team right now, the offense is obviously doing fantastic, but a lot of that has to do with basically every ball being put in play, falling for a hit. That's not going to happen all year. Starting rotation is doing fine, but they're not lasting six innings like they're going to need to. It's working now. It won't last the entire year. And the bullpen, a lot of questions still. I figure it will get better at some point because it can't get much worse. So right now, I'd be more inclined to say that this is a winning ball club than a losing one or even a 500 one. But it's 10 games. It's 6% of the season. I'm not going to put too much stock in. It's just been a fun 10-game stretch so far.
Absolutely. I agree.
I will...
Go ahead, Josh.
I will say it has not changed my original prediction. My prediction was going in that this was going to be a 77-85 win team. I thought there would be a lot of fun moments that seemed really cool and provide a lot of excitement, but there was also a lot of concern for me. And most of my concern was geared around what the pitching would do, both the starting pitching and the bullpen. And like my counterpart said, it's been only 10 games or so. I mean, we're 10 games in, and the Dodgers are 4-6. It's really hard to look at 10 games and try to draw a conclusion. But one of the best things in the National League right now is not only losing games, but they're losing games while very scarcely scoring runs. So it's really hard to really, you know, attach much of a different mindset to what we've seen in the first 10 games of the season. And I think this is going to be a team that while they might win some games 5-1, 5-4 by putting up runs. And if they keep putting up six runs a night, first off, that's some really ridiculous pace. And I don't expect that to happen because six runs a game for a Major League Baseball team is absolutely insane. So I don't expect that to keep happening. What I do expect is that there will be streaks like this, and there will be streaks that they're the exact opposite, where they may go 0-6 or 1-7 because they may average only one or two runs a game, and that may happen during a road trip as opposed to having a good homestand against a couple of bad teams. Maybe they go on the road against a couple of good teams, i.e. facing a Chicago and a St. Louis and maybe another team in the National League where it starts to even things out. Do I still think that they're a team that obviously has its strong suits? Yes, I think their offense is their strong suit. I think when Jameson Taillon's on the mound, they're a much better team than they probably are expected to, and they could probably go up against any team in baseball on that given day. It's the other 4 days of the week or the other 4 days in the rotation, so to speak, that I may not feel as strong about it. So, no, my expectation has not changed.
Yeah, and I don't really expect my expectation to change. Memorial Day is my day. That whoever's in a playoff spot around Memorial Day probably has a good shot at making the playoffs. Last year, out of the 10 teams that had a hold of the playoff spot in at Memorial Day, nine of them made the playoffs. So we got
that's absolutely true.
And I'll, month and a half until then before I really start buying a hot start.
I totally agree with that, and I'd use last season for this team as the prime example of that. This team had pretty much fallen apart by Memorial Day. Then Andrew McCutchen is a walk-off home run, and by then it's pretty much too late. Gunn was already gone. Marte was already suspended. The starting pitching had already fallen apart. Jameson Taillon had already been diagnosed with testicular cancer, and the season was already falling down the toilet. So I'd have to agree with that, too. Memorial Day is probably a pretty good gauge. And if they're still in the thick of it by, say, Father's Day, then you really start to look at what's going on here and what they do moving forward to try to keep him here. Because if they get to that point where they're still in the race by Father's Day, and by in the race, I mean, you know, one of the top two teams in the division, then you got to start looking at what they're going to do to try to sustain it and stay in the race and try to stay competitive.
The biggest thing for me is we're only, like Alex and actually both of you have said, we're only 10 games in. So we've got a very small sample size. They've, aside from their game against the Cubs yesterday, or sorry, on Tuesday and Wednesday, essentially, that's the only good team that they've played, if you want to consider the Cubs good. But with their body of work over the previous few years, they're a good team for all intents and purposes. So it's still early. You look at rivalries, and you look at teams that are good. Like, you've got the Yankees. The Yankees, with all the money that they spent this offseason, they got thumped 14-1, I believe it was, yesterday in Boston. And now they're up 8-1 in the middle of the fifth inning as we record this. Baseball's a streaky game. Anything can happen on any given night. And like Josh said, when Taillon's out in the mound, give me ace versus ace, and I'd take the Pirates. With that offense, it's great. But they've also, what they didn't do in previous years this year, is they've been able to win games against inferior opponents. The Reds have always been a nemesis, and they really haven't been good for that many years since really the wildcard game that Cueto happened. So the biggest thing I think moving forward for me is I took them to win 86 games. I like to be optimistic. Great, 78 more wins to go for me, but for both of you guys, I can see where you're coming from as far as nothing really has changed 10 games into the season. Now, once they start getting into the thick of the NL Central schedule, then we'll see where we're at. But for round one, I've got to go with Josh Taylor. I apologize, Alex. I just like his backing of his opinion. So, Josh, you're going to get to start round two. And the question is this. How long can the Pirates go on until the bullpen really starts costing them a rash of games? And both of you alluded to this previously.
I'd say give it another week or two, because if we continue to see the starters have issues like Stephen Brault's having tonight, if they get to innings 4 and 5 and Brault and Cool can't seem to get through innings 4 or 5, and Cool would probably, of all of them, is the guy who scares me the most of not being able to get through 5 complete innings. I say that while also acknowledging that this team is one of the few that are left, that their starters have gone at least 5 innings in each game they've pitched. So saying that is probably not fair, but also knowing that the quality of innings these guys have gotten to, when they get around to that second, third time through the lineup, they are not as successful. They're not as clean, and they start to become a little bit more shaky. In Brault's case, it's probably the second time through the lineup, but still. When you have that kind of problem with your starting pitching, and we saw this happen last year, when the starting pitching started to falter, the bullpen kind of came after it because it really was a chicken and egg effect. So if that's the case now, and we're seeing that starting to happen now, even with Joe Musgrove on the disabled list, just imagine what it might be like in a couple weeks if we start seeing the same pattern of, you know, Brault having a hard time getting through 5, or Cool having a hard time getting through 5, or Nova having another bad start like he did in the second game at home against the Twins. That's something that can happen. And then you can't always rely on a Jameson Taillon to bail your rotation out. Granted, that's what aces are expected to do. They're expected to stop losing streaks and either start or continue winning streaks. That's kind of what they're expected to do production-wise, which can lead to an entirely different argument about another former pitcher that everyone thought was an ace, but that's beside the point. So you can't rely on him to do that every time he comes through the rotation. You can't have him stopping the bleeding every time he comes around. Sooner or later, some other guys have to be more consistent to put a foot down. I would say Trevor Williams is probably the second most reliable guy in the rotation right now. But can Trevor Williams get you through five, six, seven innings every night on top of Tyone, in addition to Cool, who can't seem to do it more than five, in addition to Brault, who can't seem to get through five, and Nova, who probably has a bad start one out of every three? It's a lot to ask for a bullpen, which has already shown some warts with Navarauskas blowing a game, with Rivera having his issues earlier on in the season against Detroit, with Josh Smoker having his issues, and maybe not having as much of a left-handed reliable bullpen option outside of Rivera because Brault's now in the rotation because of Musgrove's injury. So sooner or later, this is going to snowball. It's just a matter of when it all comes to a head.
Yeah, honestly, right now, this team probably should have lost three or four games just because of how poorly this bullpen is pitched. That opening day in Detroit, they gave them five, six opportunities to win that game. The home opener, they gave up two earned runs and let the one runner that Tyone and the one inherited runner that they got from Tyone score also. The loss against Cincinnati, that was on the bullpen. Yesterday, or I guess it'd be Tuesday by the time people are listening to this, Edgar Santana gives up two runs and loads the bases up in two-thirds of an inning. And big problem is the roster composition. Right now there's the closer formerly known as Rivero, now Vasquez. Contos, I think, is a good reliever, but as a setup man, I think his ceiling would be about a league average guy. Michael Feliz, good young arm. He had a horrible start to the season in Detroit, but since then he's looked fairly decent. But then after it, it's kind of a mess. We got an eight-man bullpen. They've got an eight-man bullpen right now, and Clay Holmes and Tyler Glasnow are only allowed to pitch in long relief. So you essentially have a seven-man bullpen because you're not going to use both long relievers the entire time. You're taking away a roster spot. Edgar Santana and Davidus Navarauskas haven't looked good, and neither is Josh Smoker, even though I don't think he has an earned run technically against him on this season. So it's not a good setup right now. And whenever Musgrove comes back, Brault's probably just going to take Clay Holmes' spot, so you're going to have two long men again. I don't think two long men where they can't be used in high-leverage situations is a good setup for a bullpen, especially since they might have a 7-8-9, but they have no middle relief besides that. So I think if they were to replay these first 10 games, Pirates would probably only win six. I mean, this offense has bailed them out, and there's going to be 10-game stretches where they could have won, you know, 7 or 8 if they had a 2015-2014 bullpen with them, a shark tank. But they don't, and they're going to need to either find a waiver wire claim, polish him up, or if they're still hanging around by the trade deadline, they're going to need a couple relievers if nobody does step up.
Cannonballs. I agree. With the bullpen the way it is, and like we said before, they haven't played anybody good. So good teams are going to feast on bad bullpens. And obviously we're seeing that now with the Cubs. They almost came back on Tuesday in their home opener, and they've already flipped the game around on Wednesday night against the Cubs, and who knows what's going to happen. The offense has been able to bail the pitching staff out, which when you play bad teams, that's going to happen. So they need the bullpen, and I don't know, we've mentioned this on Clear the Deck, whether it's completely the bad weather and not adjusting in some of these cases, or it's just these guys aren't as good as they thought they were, and they're not performing up to expectations. But when you're losing, or when you're not using guys like Glasnow, who's played pretty and pitched pretty well this season, and Clay Holmes, who, why not see what he's got? He's a ground ball guy. They don't really have that at the moment, or at least they're not getting it out of who they've got. So I'm going to side with Alex on this one. I'm all about the roster management, and if you're going to use that bullpen, you might as well use everybody. And with Glasnow and Clay Holmes just keeping their seats warm out in the bullpen, then what's really the point? So now it's the third and final question of the evening. And what we've noticed over the course of this season so far, this young season, is the team is playing looser and a lot more freely, or so it seems, post McCutchen and Cole. So how much is not having or not having those guys impacting their play and their and the clubhouse levels.
I mean, we're seeing dance parties after every game from Polanco's Instagram feed, and yeah, we had a couple last year whenever they swept the Brewers and they had that hot streak where they won 12 out of 14, but it seems a lot looser in general. Whenever we go in for post-game interviews, Josh and I, there's music playing. There wasn't music playing in 2017 and 2016. Everyone seems looser, and it definitely can help a team, especially whenever you're young and nobody expects anything from you. You're free from the burden of expectation, especially the expectation of we are wasting Andrew McCutcheon's prime years here in Pittsburgh. We can't do that. We have to make him count. I think David Freese and Josh Harrison, a bunch of veterans came in this offseason coming into Bradenton, and they said how miserable the clubhouse had been for the last 2 years. And now Corey Dickerson, the new guy on the block, says this is the most fun he's had with the team in his career. I think that's all you need to know.
I will kind of agree with Alex on the not hearing music part, but there's a caveat to that. We're hearing more music now because they're winning games. You don't hear music in the clubhouse after you lose. And when you lose 88 games, there's a lot of music going on. Or else you don't want a Brad Pitt and Moneyball situation where he's jacking up the PA system with the bat. You don't want that. But in agreement to what he's saying, that's true. This team is a lot more loose in terms of they're able to handle things better, I think, situationally. Now, granted, this team had that kind of element last year. I mean, in the past couple seasons, we saw what they would do before games with the bubblegum buckets and the dancing in the dugout before games. So it wasn't like they didn't have that approach before. But I think the approach now is more of a, we don't really have a lot of expectations. People expected when Andrew McCutcheon and Gerrit Cole were traded, people were saying that this team may not win 60 games. Of course, those people are insane. We'll openly admit that. But the expectation for what this team could do dropped off considerably. There was no faith in what Gregory Polanco could do. There was no faith in starting Marte because he had got busted and missed 80 games for a steroid suspension. So there was that whole situation. There was nothing to be excited about because Jung Ho Gung wasn't coming back, and the guy they got back in the Gerrit Cole trade hadn't really played much in the majors. So there was nothing to be excited about. There were really no expectations because Gerrit Cole being traded made people think that, oh, your best pitcher's gone. Meanwhile, their best pitcher is healthy now, and he missed a lot of last year because he was diagnosed with testicular cancer. I thought he's been their best pitcher for the past couple years now, and just in terms of talent, composition, and mental approach to the game. And let's not kid ourselves. Gerrit Cole's mental approach has been called into question more than once, and I've been one of the people that have been calling it into question. So, yes, there has been a different kind of approach to it because I think they're not as high strung. I think there isn't as much expectation to be this, oh, we got to do all this in Andrew McCutcheon's prime years, and we got to do it while the window's still open. I don't think they're looking at it now as a window being open or an opportunity to do this while this is happening, or we might miss out on this if we don't do this. It's more of, hey, let's just go out and play, and we'll take this thing game by game. If we win, we'll celebrate it, and we'll focus on the next one. If we lose, well, we'll figure out what we did wrong and focus on the next one. And I think it's been working, and I think a lot of it is also because, like Alex mentioned, the veteran leadership in this room, I had this debate after the season ended. I said, you know, who are the real leaders in the clubhouse without Anil Walker, with Andrew McCutcheon on the way out? And the answers I came up with were guys that were still leaders last season. Jordy Mercer was a leader on this team. Josh Harrison's a leader on this team, and so is David Freese, and so is Sean Rodriguez. So these are guys that were leaders last season. But now you have a Marte, who's more of a veteran guy. A Polanco is actually more of a veteran guy. Corey Dickerson was already a veteran guy that came in, so you knew he was going to pick it up. Then you have guys like Cervelli and Nova in spring training saying, look, we know we got to pick up the mantle and be the veteran guys in the room because they're only one of a couple that are over 30, if you count Harrison, Mercer, Rodriguez, and Freese in that group. But the guys that are 30 years and over have really picked up the mantle and said, we have to be the guys that lead the charge here. And some of these guys that are here have seen success with this team in the case of Harrison and Mercer, and even to a degree Cervelli. So they know what they're walking into. But is there still that degree of, we're going to go out and win each game that we play? I think that also plays into it. And a lot of it probably has to do with the fact that no one expects them to. They say, you know what? They're not going to count on us. They're not going to expect us to do it. They're not going to believe in us. We got to believe in us. And I think it's working.
Right. And you bring up a good point. as far as the leadership goes. It used to be Neil Walker and A.J. Burnett, and then it transitioned to McCutchen and Cole, and now I guess you could really say the veterans and Tyone. Now, I'm going to ask a follow-up question to this. Do you think the club's attitude or has changed because of the change in leadership now that it isn't Andrew McCutchen's team or it isn't Garrett Cole's team? Now you can see guys flourish in a role that really maybe they were too afraid to play because when they got here or got called up, it was somebody else's squad.
Probably. I mean, it's Mad Max pretty much. Cervelli said, you know, after Tuesday's game, there's no rules in the clubhouse. People can be themselves. And you look at the guys who they lost. Was it Chris Stewart who was putting in all those rules? I doubt it. Was it John Jaso? Doubt it. It's going to be your best hitter and it's going to be your best pitcher, most likely. So right now they get to be themselves and it's working. There's really no other way to say it. They are free of the burden of expectation. Even now that they're 8-2, or by the time people were listening to this, either 9-2 or 8-3, people still don't expect anything from this team. Josh and I even started off with saying, no, our expectations for this team are pretty much the same, and I don't think they'd rather have it any other way.
I'll add on to that by saying not only is this group not burdened by expectation, I think all of these guys have had their own individual bouts with failure and adversity too. So they're no longer afraid of failure. Gregory Polanco was a 22 home run guy 2 seasons ago. Starling Marte was an all-star 2 seasons ago. And then last season, Polanco's on the DL 3 different times with the same hamstring injury. Marte gets popped for 80 games for PEDs. Josh Harrison's a 2-time all-star. These guys have all had measures of success. Josh Bell hit 26 last year as a rookie. So he's had a measure of success. Jordy Mercer's been a pretty good shortstop for a while. Francisco Cervelli's been around for a while. We know how long that David Freese and Sean Rodriguez have been here. So we know what to expect from them. David Freese was a World Series MVP. So these guys have had measures of success. But last season, a lot of these guys also had measures of failure. I think the only guy whose season went probably as good as planned, if not better, was Josh Bell. Everybody else had their issues. Harrison ended up missing time because he got hit in the hand. Cervelli had injury issues. Mercer had his injury problems, and he kind of had his cold spells. Marte had the suspension. Polanco had his injury. Frazier had his injuries. Garrett Cole gave up home runs left and right. Ivan Nova hit the wall in August after being really steady from April through July. So all these guys, from the top guy down, for the most part, except for maybe Colin Moran, who doesn't have a lot of experience in the bigs yet, and I'll say the same thing for Elias Diaz, the rest of these guys have seen the ups and downs. They've had the highs and lows. They've been able to come in and succeed and also deal with that punchback that Clint Hurdle talks about all the time. How's the league going to punch back, and how are they going to adjust? They've dealt with that now. So now there's no fear of failure because they've already failed. There's no fear of how they'll handle success because they've already had some marginal levels of success. And now it's just we take what we've learned. And another thing that I'll quickly drop in here, they share a lot of information with each other. They share experiences and what they've seen and what they've dealt with to help the next guy. And I don't know if that always happened over the past couple seasons. I think that's a new added element that we haven't always seen. These guys communicate and actually work together to help the other guy be better. All those things add up for me right now, and I think it turns into a clubhouse that actually works together. It's one of those intangible things that you can't always look at a number and say, well, this is what this team did. But if you have that now, early in the season, as opposed to maybe as it grows over time, if you can start out of the gate with that, you're probably better off than most teams are.
So what you're saying, Josh, is that this is actually a team playing like a team.
Exactly. I think you have guys that are a lot more open to communicate with each other. They're a lot more open to not try to do everything themselves. They're relying on the next guy. They're saying, okay, if I can't do it, the next guy is going to pick me up. Or if I can't do it, or if I fail, I'm going to help the next guy succeed. And I don't think we always saw that with these past couple years with those teams. I think we saw a little bit in 2013 and maybe 2014 and 2015. But these last couple seasons, we hadn't seen it as much. And probably a lot of it had to do with the leadership. I think A.J. Burnett had that kind of air about him. Says, look, I'm going to go out and kick someone's ass. And then next after I do it, the next guy's going to come out and do it because I'm going to help him. And I don't know if that always stayed the way it probably should have, even after he left. But there's more of that attitude there now than maybe had been the past couple of years. And we had seen it more during the better years when they made that run of 3 straight postseasons.
And to bring up,
go ahead.
For I like what Josh just said about AJ. I'm going to bring up another point on that. With AJ, he knew this was his last stop in 2015, mm-hmm. so he could do that all the time. Gerrit Cole, on the other hand, knew his entire this entire time that he is not going to be a Pirate for much longer. He knew that back in 2016 whenever they tried screwing him out of, what was it, like $20,000 out of a pre-arb salary?
Right.
Which is stupid.
And they threw a lower-level guy under the bus because of it.
Yeah, it was dumb. He was coming off an all-star season, and they're like, all right, you're getting a pay decrease, which is terrible. Andrew McCutchen knew he wasn't going to be a Pirate forever. Jameson Taillon, Josh Bell, basically everyone on this team, besides, I believe, Jordy Mercer, is signed for next year.
Yep.
Everyone of consequence. They know they're going to be here for a while, which makes sharing information a lot easier, which leads to a looser clubhouse. There is no, where am I going to be next year? It's going to be, I am a Pittsburgh Pirate for 2018, 2019, 2020. I think that is probably, being free of that, one of the biggest differences between this clubhouse and previous ones.
Do either of you guys think, and obviously you two would know more about the clubhouse and the pulse of the clubhouse than I would, unless these guys were playing in Altoona over the last 2 years. Do either of you think that either Andrew McCutchen or Gerrit Cole wanted to be the leaders that they actually were once they got here? And do you think that played a role in the way that the clubhouse kind of functioned while they were here?
I think McCutchen genuinely wanted to be. I think he knew he expected to be when he got here. I think Andrew McCutchen knew when he finally made it here and came of age after a year or two that he knew what his role was going to be. He knew he was going to be the face of the franchise, and I think he embraced it for the most part. I think it got harder and harder to be that guy by himself when guys that were around him, like Neil Walker, like Russell Martin, like Pedro Alvarez, are starting to leave, and he goes, okay, looks like I got to try to do this by myself. So it probably became a little bit harder to do that. Gerrit Cole coming in didn't have to be the guy right away. He got to actually watch some other dudes, like A.J. Burnett, you know, watch those guys and have those guys teach him how to do it when he finally got the opportunity. And I think he was starting to show a little bit some shades of that, just mentoring these younger guys like Williams and Brault and Cool last season in the clubhouse. And I saw a couple minor examples of it, just telling them, okay, well, remember, we got to do this. We got to go do this. This is how you do that. So you saw a little bit of it, but it never really fully got to fruition because there was so much of it with Gerrit Cole not being able to get out of Gerrit Cole's own head. And it really reflected in his walk and home run totals. I think that's part of it because, you know, he's trying to fight himself on the mound while also trying to be this leader, and it might have been too much too soon for him. Had it been a year or two from now, maybe he feels a lot differently about it. I think that's part of his success in Houston because he doesn't have to be the guy. He's behind two perennial best pitchers in the AL in Dallas Keuchel and Justin Verlander. He's the fourth best guy in the rotation if you want to count McCullers in that group. So he doesn't have to be the guy in Houston. He just has to go out and be a guy. Whereas here, he had to be the guy and might not have been completely ready for it. McCutchen was a different story. We knew he was prepared for it, and I think he wore those shoes more often than not. When he played well, he said, look, I just got to keep doing what I'm doing. When he didn't play well, he'd come out and admit it. You know what? I suck right now. And that's what leaders are able to do. Cole wasn't able to do that as well because I think he just hadn't gone through enough adversity yet. He almost didn't know how to fail. Think about his career at UCLA and how good he was then. Coming out of the draft, number one overall guy, gets called up, flies through the minors. In his first season, this team goes to wild card game. So his first 3 years had really been nothing but success unless he had gotten hurt. He really hadn't failed and been knocked down yet. Last year was really the first example of that. So he never really got that chance to learn how to fail and then learn how to recover from it, whereas McCutchen had a couple times. So maybe now when you have more guys that have been through it and a collection of them as opposed to one or two, maybe – not addition by subtraction, so to speak, but the collective experience gets better. The collective learning process gets better as opposed to just one or two guys that have been through it. And I think that makes a difference.
Yeah, I have nothing I can add on to what Josh said about McCutchen. That was 10 out of 10. But one thing I wanted to add to Gerrit Cole was 2015, obviously AJ was running the show, as was 2013,
right,
whenever Cole was a rookie. Start of 2016 – you can argue he wasn't the guy yet. They still had Liriano
exactly
on the team. Yeah, they didn't have Liriano
on the team. That's exactly what I believe.
And then they had Yeah, and they also had Mark Melanson, and then those guys were traded mid-season, and here's Gerrit Cole, like you said, in the first season where he has failed as a major leaguer, he's hurt all the time, and it's, well, now you're the guy for pitching. It was a terrible right. situation to be handed the reins. And I
yeah,
think
that really bad timing for him.
Yeah, it was the worst possible timing for him, and he just never really adjusted, I don't think. And I think that was really what was holding him back. Had they hung on to Melanson and Liriano at the end of 2016 and then at the start of 2017, he comes in and he knows he's the guy. Maybe in a parallel universe, he would have been able to accept the challenges and do better under it. But I think throwing him in mid-season in the worst season of his career definitely did screw with his head a bit.
Cannonballs. My thing with Gerrit Cole is, and especially now, you look, he's in Houston, and he's in, so far he's thrown very well. And like you said, he's probably the fourth or fifth guy down there as far as where he would be at in that rotation. Because that rotation is scary good. Obviously, they're the defending World Series champions for a reason. And going out and getting a guy like Verlander only boosted that rotation. But now you've got a leader in Tyon who with Nova, I think they would probably share that role pretty well. But he's a guy playing with house money. He's obviously been a highly touted prospect. He's dealt with injuries and had to overcome this, that, and the other thing. But he's got something. He's had a life near-death experience, and he's overcome that. He's beat cancer. He's playing with house money, in my opinion. So he gets to go out and play the game the way that he can play day in and day out and relax. And you talked about Josh Bell earlier. Last year, there really weren't very many expectations for him. You got a switch hitter guy, rookie. First part of the season, he was getting replaced defensively. Then towards the end of the year, the trust was there. He performed admirably, and now he's there for the next couple of years. But what we've seen now, I think, is more of a team. They're embracing being the underdog again. And I think that's really paid off for them of late. Just of note, Sidney Crosby has got a hat trick in game one of the Stanley Cup playoffs. Of course, Sidney doing Sid things.
This is a Pirates podcast. Who cares?
Right, but his first goal, he batted out of the air.
it's a big shocker, right? Sid scoring a hat trick against the Flyers. Big shock, right?
Right, exactly. But the biggest thing I take away from that is I think Sidney Crosby could be placed in the Pirates lineup when they DH. And I would imagine he could probably even play the field somewhere, anywhere, I would imagine.
He has hit a home run at PNC Park during batting practice. It has happened before. It happened, what, 10 years ago in that first Stanley Cup run? So it wouldn't be out of the realm of possibility. Just saying. He's
athletic
enough. The
way that he bats pucks out of the air, he could be a very good middle-of-the-order hitter, I think, for the Buccos. But
and he's got a ridiculous trunk. He can generate some bat speed. That's all I'm saying.
the hips don't lie.
Big trunk.
The hips definitely don't lie, especially with hockey players. But squeezing him into some baseball pants might be a little bit difficult. But after deliberating with the voices in my head over countless minutes of debate, educated debate about Pirates, this, that, and the other thing, it's time for an answer. Alex, if you could give me a drum roll, that'd be greatly appreciated. I appreciate that. And the winner that I have selected, and I know this might cause some controversy, is Josh Taylor. Congratulations.
It was because of the drum roll, wasn't it?
I really wasn't. I didn't know what to expect for the drum roll, but he brought it. And a lot. And it when you have educated debates like this, we all, I think, agreed on a lot of points. So coming up with that is difficult, but we all agreed, I think, pretty much on every topic. But it's just one of those things where he brought it, and you both did.
I didn't even have to reference Andrew McCutcheon's belly button this time around. That's his first for me.
Well, save that for a rainy day.
So
it's kind of my trademark. Everybody has their thing. Everybody has a signature. That's mine.
See, I have Curve Burgers. Alex has... Alex, what's your signature?
I don't know. Being a nerd, I guess. Number nerd.
We got to come up with a signature for you.
I need a signature. Yeah.
So while you're now no longer on the shelf as the reigning champion of Cannonballs, it is your goal to find yourself your claim to fame, your go-to. Like, mine's Curb Burgers. Everybody knows that. I'm an Altoona guy. I don't love spending $9 for a cheeseburger. However, I love Curb Burgers. Josh's is a belly button of Andrew McCutcheon's. What's yours?
Andrew McCutcheon's belly button. It's the thing.
I had baseball quiz, but they took that away from me. So I got to find a new one.
You find yours, your signature, and then hopefully we'll have another intelligent debate. Josh, the floor is yours if you want to have a couple minutes to spew your knowledge.
I think the thing that surprises me the most about this team, not the offense, not the runs they've scored, and not even the home runs, it's the at-bats that they've had. It's the patience that they've shown. It's the ability to even fall behind in the count and then work your way back into it. I wrote about this earlier in the week on Locked On Pirates. One of the things that kind of caught my attention is that three of the bigger at-bats that they've had this season have all been with runners on base, and they've all managed to get themselves having lengthy at-bats and getting themselves in a favorable count to make impact. One of them was Gregory Polanco on opening day, crushing that 3-0 pitch in the 13th inning for the game winner. Then you have Colin Moran in the home opener, working that count full and blasting a grand slam, his first of his career. Then he does it again against Cincinnati, two runners on base. Actually, with bases loaded again, and he works the count, I think it was a 2-2, and then drives in two runs with a base hit. So you just see the quality of at-bats are so much better, whether it is the communication like we talked about earlier, whether it is Jeff Branson, whether it is just the guys having the experience that they've had and bringing it to the table. The way that they're attacking these games, these innings, at bat by at bat, inning by inning, is really impressive. And it's starting to become a staple of this team early on.
I couldn't have said it any better myself. I do agree, especially their quality at bats have been great. And really, situational hitting has been phenomenal. And I know previous years, they couldn't hit a sac fly to save their lives. They couldn't do much of anything. But this year, it's been a breath of fresh air. Whatever that reason might be, it just needs to keep happening. So it'll be.
And the number four guy who's a good situational hitter, who's finally becoming the number four guy. He finally has one in Josh Bell. I think that contributes to it, too. That's a big part of it.
Right, and you have guys that really can hit anywhere in the lineup and still be productive. You have Dickinson and Moran batting later in the lineup, and then you have a guy like Jordy Mercer, who hits eighth against righties, but number two against lefties. So
it's really good in both slots.
Right, the complexity of the roster in the lineup has been great. So it'll be interesting to see how the Pirates do now that the season heats up. They've got another game against Chicago on Thursday. And then they head to Miami, and the Marlins have been floundering, I guess fish puns intended. So it'll be good to get down there and play again, get out of the cold of Chicago, and really the cold of the Northeast, and hopefully win a couple ball games. But for my counterparts, Alex Stumpf and our victorious Josh Taylor, this has been Jared Prugar on Cannonballs, on Locked On Pirates, your Pittsburgh Pirates podcast of choice. Thank you and have a good day.